K-Mud Podcast presents.
Today I have a very special show for you. Tomorrow is Martin Luther King's real birthday. Next Monday is the day that the country celebrates it, although we have a president that is in total denial, has removed anything about Martin Luther King that he can from the schools everywhere. And we have so much to learn today from Martin Luther King of what's happening. And I could talk about everything. It's horrible things that are happening in Minneapolis. The fact that three Lakotas are imprisoned at Fort Schilling, after being seized by ICE in Minneapolis, and Fort Schilling is the site of the removal and genocide of the Dakota people. That's where they were holding the 38. They were hung at Mikado at Fort Schilling. And according to Oglala President Frank A Star comes out. The irony is not lost on us. Lakota citizens who are reported to be held at Fort Schilling, a site forever tied to the Dakota 38 plus 2. This is not a misunderstanding or an enforcement desecration issue. This is a treaty violation. Treaties are not optional. Sovereignty is not conditional, and our citizens are not negotiable. But what I want to do is share with you what I'm going to play today, and it's the rally that happened in 1963, where Martin Luther King gave his I Have a Dream speech. And it says, I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. The words came over the public address system almost at the close of an historic moment in America. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, was speaking. It had been a long, hot day. As top leaders of the march spoke to the huge audience, demonstrators who had come from every part of the United States collapsed in the boiling sun and had to be carted away on stretchers. When we speak of preparing ourselves for the future, we often think in terms of getting ready to meet some coming evil. Seldom are we prepared for the good events in life. So it was on Wednesday, August 28th of 1963, in the greatest rally for jobs and freedom in the history of the United States, when more than 200,000 marched in an orderly and peaceful mood. Washington, D.C. was prepared. Truck convoys of army troops swept across the city while citizens slept. Combat-ready troops raced to take up strategic positions along the route of the march as the dawn rose cool and clear. Police, standing not more than 5 feet apart, prepared to encircle the periphery of the law-making area of the nation's capital, while district police and National Guardsmen were preparing to locate on practically every downtown corner. Washington, D.C. was indeed prepared. Well, Washington, D.C. was, however, totally unprepared for the goodness and dedication in the hearts of those who came from far and near to peacefully protest racial discrimination and the lack of equal employment opportunities in America. The sympathy of the entire freedom-loving world was with the marchers that day, and they were a proud, reverent group to behold. The march began a half hour early. It was rumored that one of the groups arriving early assembled and walked past the Washington Monument, started pointing and heading to the Lincoln Memorial. Thousands of waiting demonstrators, seeing the group advancing, thought the march had begun and fell in step behind. The premature start stranded the march leaders who had been scheduled to lead the procession. However, a space was cleared for them immediately behind a drum and bugle corps, and they marched shoulder to shoulder. The vast crowd broke into an ear-splitting cheer when they first sighted the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., leader of countless civil rights demonstrations across the United States. 24 hours earlier, Washington, D.C. had been just another section of the country contemplating a protest demonstration. These marches were not new to America. Birmingham, Detroit, Chicago, St. Louis, Los Angeles had all felt the power of minority groups protesting the way in which they were being treated. The June 23rd March for Freedom in Detroit was destined to take a back seat to the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. The marchers poured in from every direction past a World War I memorial and down both sides of a half-mile-long reflecting pool that separates Constitution and Independence Avenues. "We shall overcome" rang through the air as they came by train, bus, plane, and car to press demands for equality. And by the thousands, they came to focus worldwide attention on their course. There was a deep tone of fervor and dedication to the task at hand. Folk singers sang protest songs of the 60s, while Mahalia Jackson sang the hymns of oppression that had been wrung from the throats of Negroes down through the ages. Gravity reflected on the faces of the marchers as more than 10,000 officers and marshals were corralled to guarantee the right of peaceful assembly for the demonstration. Not a hint of apprehension was felt as the sea of heads, signs, and voices moved down the wide expanse of grass, and mobile service and helicopters stood ready at Fort Belvoir, Fort Meade, Fort Myers, and Quantico, all military installations to move troops where needed at a moment's notice. Boy, doesn't that sound familiar. Okay, pass the bill, pass the bill, pass the bill was the cry heard when senators and congressmen moved to the area especially reserved for them. This was demand for action on President John Kennedy's civil rights program then before the 88th Congress of the United States. But the day was fast drawing to a close. Dr. King stood, acknowledged the crowd of the throng, then said, five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And all the while, the unseeing eyes of Abraham Lincoln looked over at the mass of people at his feet. And maybe he could have, or maybe he would have wept, as did many in attendance, over the fact that 100 years had passed, now passed, and the people whom he set out to be free are still struggling in the octopus-like grip of racial discrimination. And what you're going to hear, preserved for posterity, we hear Dr. King and other civil rights leaders sharing the occasion with Dr. King were Roy Wilkins, Executive Secretary of the NAACP, Whitney M. Young, Executive Secretary of the National Urban League, Walter Rudar, President of UAW, and A. Philip Randolph, President of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And the MC in this is Ralph Randolph. Please enjoy and learn.
Fellow Americans, we are gathered here in the largest demonstration in the history of this nation. Let the nation and the world know the meaning of our numbers. We are not a pressure group. We are not an organization or a group of organizations. We are not a mob. We are the advance guard of a massive moral revolution for jobs and freedom. This revolution reverberates throughout the land, touching every city, every town, every village where black men are segregated, oppressed, and exploited. But this civil rights revolution is not confined to the Negro. Nor is it confined to civil rights, for our white allies know that they cannot be free while we are not, and we know that we have no future in a society in which 6 million black and white people are unemployed and millions more living poverty. Nor is the goal of our civil rights revolution merely the passage of civil rights legislation. Yes, we want all public accommodations open to all citizens, but those accommodations will mean little to those who cannot afford to use them. Yes, we want a Fair Employment Practice Act But what good will it do if profit-geared automation destroys the jobs of millions of workers, black and white? We want integrated public schools, but that means we also want federal aid to education, all forms of education. We want a free democratic society dedicated to the political, economic, and social advancement of man along moral lines. Now, we know that real freedom will require many changes in the nation's political and social philosophies and institutions. For one thing, we must destroy the notion that Mrs. Murphy's property rights include the right to humiliate me because of the color of my skin. The sanctity of private property takes second place to the sanctity of the human personality. It falls to the Negro to reassert this proper priority of values because our ancestors were transformed from human personalities into private property. It falls to us to demand new forms of social planning, to create full employment, and to put automation at the service of human needs, not at the service of profits. We are the worst victims of unemployment. Negroes are in the forefront of today's movement for social and racial justice because we know they cannot expect the realization of their aspirations, our aspirations, through the same old anti-democratic social institutions and philosophies that have all along frustrated our aspirations. And so we have taken our struggle into the streets. As the labor movement took its struggle into the streets, as Jesus Christ led the multitude through the streets of Judea, the plain and simple fact is that until we went into the streets, the federal government was indifferent to our demands. It was not until the streets and jails of Birmingham were filled that Congress began to think about civil rights legislation. It was not until thousands demonstrated in the South that lunch counters and other public accommodations were integrated. It was not until the Freedom Riders were brutalized in Alabama that the 1946 Supreme Court decision banning discrimination in interstate travel was enforced. And it was not until construction sites were picketed in the North that Negro workers were hired. Those who deplore are militants who exhort patience in the name of a false peace are in fact supporting segregation and exploitation. They would have social peace at the expense of social and racial justice. They are more concerned with easing racial tension than enforcing racial democracy. The months and years ahead will bring new evidence of masses in motion for freedom. The March on Washington is not the climax of our struggle, but a new beginning, not only for the Negro, but for all Americans who thirst for freedom and a better life. Look for the enemies of Medicare, of higher minimum wages, of Social Security, of federal aid to education, and there you will find the enemy of the Negro, the coalition of Dixocrats and reactionary Republicans that seek to dominate the Congress. We must develop strength in order that we may be able to back and support the civil rights program of President Kennedy. In the struggle against these forces, all of us should be prepared to take to the streets the spirit and techniques that built the labor movement, founded churches, and now guide the civil rights revolution. Must be a massive crusade must be launched against the unholy coalition of Dixocrats and the racists that seek to strangle Congress. We here today are on the first wave. When we leave, it will be to carry on the civil rights revolution home with us into every nook and cranny of the land. And we shall return again and again to Washington in every growing numbers until total freedom is ours. Fellow Americans, I now have the opportunity and pleasure to present to you a great American, Walter Reuther, President of the United Automobile Workers of America and Vice President of the American Federation of Labor and Congress of Industrial Organization, Walter Reuther.
Brother Randolph, fellow Americans and friends, I am here today with you because with you I share the view that the struggle for civil rights and the struggle for equal opportunity is not the struggle of Negro Americans, but the struggle for every American to join in. For 100 years, the Negro people have searched for first-class citizenship. And I believe that they cannot and should not wait until some distant tomorrow. They should demand freedom now, here and now. It is the responsibility of every American to share the impatience of the Negro Americans. And we need to join together, to march together, and to work together until we bridge the moral gap between American democracy's noble promises and its ugly practices in the field of civil rights. American democracy has been too long on pious platitudes and too short on practical performance in this important area. Now, one of the problems is what I call that there is too much high-octane hypocrisy in America. There is a lot of noble talk about brotherhood, and then some Americans drop the brother and keep the hood. To me, the civil rights question is a moral question, which transcends partisan politics. And this rally today should be the first step in a total effort to mobilize the moral conscience of America and to ask the people in Congress of both parties to rise above their partisan differences and enact civil rights legislation now. Now, the President, President Kennedy, has offered a comprehensive but moderate bill. That bill is the first meaningful step. It needs to be strengthened. It needs FEPC and other stronger provisions. And the job question is crucial because we will not solve education or housing or public accommodations as long as millions of Americans, Negroes, are treated as second-class economic citizens and denied jobs. And as one American, I take the position, if we can have full employment and full production for the negative ends of war, then why can't we have a job for every American in the pursuit of peace? And so our slogan has got to be, fair employment, but fair employment within the framework of full employment so that every American can have a job. I am for civil rights as a matter of human decency, as a matter of common morality. But I am also for civil rights because I believe that freedom is an indivisible value, that no one can be free unto himself, And when Bull Connor with his police dogs and fire hoses destroys freedom in Birmingham, he is destroying my freedom in Detroit. And let us keep in mind, since we are the strongest of the free nations of the world, since you cannot make your freedom secure, excepting as we make freedom universal so all may enjoy its blessings, let us understand that we cannot defend freedom in Berlin so long as we deny freedom in Birmingham. This rally is not the end, it's the beginning. It's the beginning of a great moral crusade to arouse America to the unfinished work of American democracy. The Congress has to act. And after they act, we have much work to do in the vineyards of American democracy in every community. Men of goodwill must join together. Men of all races and creed and color and political persuasion, and motivated by the spirit of human brotherhood, we must search for answers in the light of reason through rational and responsible action. Because if we fail, the vacuum of our failure will be filled by the apostles of hatred, who will search in the dark of night, and reason will yield to riots, and brotherhood will yield to bitterness and bloodshed, and we will tear asunder the fabric of American democracy. So let this be the beginning of that great crusade to mobilize the moral conscience of America so that we can win freedom and justice and equality and first-class citizen for every American, not just for certain Americans, not only in certain parts of America, but in every part of America, from Boston to Birmingham, from New York to New Orleans, and from Michigan to Mississippi. Thank you.
We will now listen to a great American and a dedicated leader, the acknowledged champion of civil rights in America, Mr. Roy Wilkins, Executive Secretary, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Brother Roy Wilkins.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Put on, Roy. Put on, Roy. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Randolph. First of all, I want to thank all of you for coming here today because you saved me from being a liar. I told them you would be here. They didn't believe me because you always make up your mind at the last minute. And you had me scared. But isn't it a great day?
Yes.
My friends, we're here today because we want the Congress of the United States to hear from us in person what many of us have been telling our public officials back home, and that is, we want freedom now. We came here to petition our lawmakers to be as brave as our sit-ins and our marchers, to be as daring as James Meredith, to be as unafraid as the nine children of Little Rock, and to be as forthright as the governor of North Carolina, and to be as dedicated as the Archbishop of St. Louis. We came to speak here to our Congress, to those men and women who speak here for us in that marble forum over yonder on the hill. They know from their vantage point here of the greatness of this whole nation, of its reservoirs of strength, and of the sicknesses which threaten always to sap its strength and to erode in one or another selfish and stealthy and specious fashion the precious liberty of the individual, which is the hallmark of our country among the nations of the earth. We have come asking the enactment of legislation that will affirm the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that will place the resources and the honor of the government of all the people behind the Pledge of Equality and the Declaration of Independence. We want employment, and with it, we want the pride and responsibility and self-respect that goes with equal access to jobs. Therefore, we want an FEPC bill as a part of the legislative package. Now, my friends all over this land, and especially in parts of the Deep South, we are beaten and kicked and maltreated and shot and killed by local and state law enforcement officers. It is simply incomprehensible to us here today and to millions of others far from this spot that the United States government, which can regulate the contents of a pill, apparently is powerless to prevent the physical abuse of citizens within its own borders. The Attorney General must be empowered to act on his own initiative in the denial of any civil right, not just one or two, but any civil right, in order to wipe out this shameful situation. Now, the President's proposals represent so moderate an approach that if it is weakened or eliminated, the remainder will be little more than sugar water. Indeed, as it stands today, the package needs strengthening, and the President should join us in fighting to be sure that we get something more than PAP. And finally, we hear talk of protocol and procedures and rules, including the Senate filibuster rule. Well, we have a thought on that. We declare that rules are made to enable the Congress to legislate and not to keep it from legislating. And we're tired of hearing rules cited as a reason why they can't act. We expect the passage of an effective civil rights bill. We commend those Republicans in both houses who are working for it. We salute those Democrats in both houses who are working for it. In fact, we even salute those from the South who want to vote for it but don't dare to do so. And we say to those people, just give us a little time, and one of these days, we'll emancipate you. It'll get to the place where they can come to a civil rights rally, too. If those who support the bill will fight for it as hard and as skillfully as the Southern opposition fights against it, victory will be ours. When we return home, keep up the speaking by letter and telegram and telephone and wherever possible by a personal visit. Remember that this has been a long fight. We were reminded of it by the news of the death yesterday in Africa of Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois. Now, regardless of the fact that in his later years, Dr. Du Bois chose another path, it is incontrovertible that at the dawn of the 20th century, his was the voice that was calling to you to gather here today in this cause. If you want to read something that applies to 1963, go back and get a volume of The Souls of Black Folks by Du Bois, published in 1903. Well, my friends, you got religion here today. Don't blackslide tomorrow. Remember Luke's account of the warning that was given to us all. No man, he wrote, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. Thank you.
Next speaker is the brilliant executive director of the National Urban League, Whitney M. Young, J.R., one of the leaders of the civil rights movement.
Brother Randolph, fellow Americans, the National Urban League is honored to be a participant in this historic occasion. Our presence here not only reflects the civil rights community's increased respect for and awareness of the Urban League's role, but most important, it says, and I hope loud and clear, that while intelligence, maturity, and strategy dictate that as civil rights agencies we use different methods, we are all united as never before on the goal of first-class citizenship for all Americans now. That we meet here today in common cause, not as white people, nor as black people, nor as members of any particular group, is a tribute to those Americans who dare to live up and to practice our democratic ideals and our religious heritage. That we meet here today is a tribute also to all black Americans who for 100 years bear witness to our deep faith in America and in this method of protest to effect change. That we meet here at all, however, is to the shame of some who have always blocked the progress of the brown American, and to the shame of those who would make deals, would water down civil rights legislation, or take cowardly refuge in technical details around elementary human rights, and who would even now delay until after Christmas the consideration of these bills before Congress. One should not seek here to atone for his past failures as a responsible citizen of the majority group. The evils of the past and the guilt about it cannot be erased by a one-day pilgrimage, however magnificent. Nor can this pilgrimage substitute for an obligation to tomorrow by these same citizens. And so this march must go beyond this historic moment. For the true test of the rededication and the commitment which should flow from this meeting will be in recognition that however impressed or however incensed our congressional representatives are by this demonstration, they will not act because of it alone. We must support the strong. We must give courage to the timid. We must remind the indifferent. And we must warn the opposed. Civil rights, which are God-given and constitutionally guaranteed, are not negotiable in 1963. Furthermore, we must work together even more closely back home where the job must be done, to see that Negro Americans are accepted as first-class citizens and that they are enabled to do some more marching. They must march from the rat-infested, overcrowded ghettos to decent, wholesome, unrestricted residential areas dispersed throughout our cities. They must march from the relief rolls to the established retraining centers, from underemployment as unskilled workers to higher occupations commensurate with our skills. They must march from the cemeteries where our newborn died 3 times sooner and our parents died 7 years earlier. They must march from there to established health and welfare centers. They must march from the congested, ill-equipped schools which breed dropouts and which smother motivation to the well-equipped, integrated facilities throughout the city. They must march from the play areas in crowded and unsafe streets to the newly opened areas in the parks and recreational centers. And finally, they must march from a present feeling of despair and hopelessness, despair and frustration, to a renewed faith and confidence due to intangible programs and visible changes made possible only by walking together, to the PTA meetings, to the libraries, to the decision-making bodies, to the schools and the colleges, to the adult education centers for all age groups, to the voter registration booth. The hour is late. The gap is widening. The rumble of the drums of discontent resounding throughout this land are heard in all parts of the world. The missions which we send there to keep the world safe for democracy are shallow symbols unless with them goes the living testament that this country practices at home the doctrine which it seeks to promote abroad. How serious our national leaders are will be measured not by words but by the speed and sincerity with which they pass necessary legislation, with which they admit to the tragic injustice that has been done our country and its Negro citizens by historic discrimination and rejection, and until they take intensive remedial steps to correct the damage in order to give true meaning to the words equal opportunity. This is the real significance of our march today, August 28, 1963. Our march is a march for America. It is a march just begun.
At this time, I have the honor to present to you the moral leader of our nation. A great, dedicated man. A philosopher of a non-violent system of behavior in seeking to bring about social change for the advancement of justice and freedom and human dignity. I have the pleasure to present to you Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination 100 years later. The Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity 100 years later. The Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. And so we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summit of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until that is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people. who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. And they have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friends, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. And every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain. And the crooked places will be made straight. And the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. And all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, tears of thee. Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring." And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
This has been a K-Mite podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.